So welcome to our day long, and today is more or less like a regular one-day sitting that we do from 9 to 4:30, except the theme of the day will be mindfulness of emotions. So there'll be more focus on practice of mindfulness in relationship to emotions. I don't have great ambition for the day in terms of resolving everyone's possible issues around emotions and that you'll become experts and but just to begin kind of emphasizing the importance of mindfulness of emotions and some of the tools of mindfulness and working with them. As I got out of my car just now, just flashed through my mind that I should have titled the day, maybe should I apologize before I tell you, but I thought of Emotions Are Us. Because I was thinking emotions are so central to being a human being. And so we need to look at them. We need to include them as part of the practice. I think part of the strength of mindfulness practice as a spiritual practice is that it attempts to be all-inclusive. It tends to include all aspects of our humanity, all our experience, as part of practice, as including as part of something we pay attention to. As opposed to just saying, this is important, you know, this is what we pay attention to. This over here, we don't pay attention to. We exclude that from awareness. This is unacceptable. My hate, that's unacceptable, you know, I just ignore it. My greed or, you know, all kinds of things that people, you know, very commonly in our culture and probably in your own psyche, certainly in my own, a tendency to separate out what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, what's sacred and what's not sacred, what's whatever. And so what we're trying to do in mindfulness is to include everything as part of the practice and not have any outside, nothing that for the purposes of mindfulness is unacceptable. For the purposes of how you want to behave among your friends and family and neighbors, I mean, there certainly are things which are considered unacceptable. We don't go around and, you know, beat people up. But in terms of what we open awareness to is to really include and feel and see and admit and be honest about, nothing's considered unacceptable. So we meet it with that friendly attitude of mindfulness. And then hopefully with that as a foundation, then we decide what is a wise way of acting in the world. So everything is, so emotions are included. I'm aware that in America, maybe even in California, maybe this part of California, there's a trend or a tendency left over from maybe the 60s and 70s to validate emotions too much. And people have manifestos about their beliefs around emotions. They'll kill, you know, based on their beliefs around emotions. You know, certain people, I wouldn't want to be in a debate with them about, you know, how you're supposed to relate to your emotions. And sometimes there's an overvaluation of the importance of emotions. And focusing on emotions for this day, I don't want to, single it out as, but this is like, you know, all important, or this is the defining characteristic of what our life is all about. It just happens to be that it's, you know, one of the important areas. Early in the year, I focused a whole day on mindfulness of breathing. That was as important as a whole day on emotions. Then we had a second day on mindfulness of the body, and that's as important, maybe more important than just doing emotions. And today it's emotions. So not to single out as being the most important, but rather it has its important place in this wider mandala of who we are as human beings, as important as other things. I am also aware there's a lot of people who undervaluate their emotions, and some people have emotional illiteracy. They're not aware of their emotions. They don't know they don't have a big vocabulary for the emotions. And there's a kind of a story that goes around in our circles of someone who came to retreat and came to interview and said, I'm having something unusual is happening to me. I don't know quite what it is, but it's quite unusual. And then coming back the next interview or two and say, oh, I figured out what it is. I'm calm. And the person had never really experienced calm. It didn't have the vocabulary to identify it when it came up. So some people, you know, don't have the vocabulary to identify certain emotions. And some people are shut off. Not so uncommon for me to have someone come and tell me that they don't feel anything from their neck down. And if you don't feel anything from your neck down, you don't have that good access to the wide range of emotions and the subtlety of emotions and how they work and for us. So there can be the over-evaluation and there can be the under-evaluation of emotions. And for us as Buddhist practitioners, we're trying actually to do neither, but rather to meet each emotion that arises in and of itself as it is, very honestly, very directly, very friendly, and in doing that, be very balanced about it, not putting meaning on it that's beyond what it is, and not under, you know, both meaning both in terms of it's unacceptable or wonderful, or we're not trying to celebrate emotions, and we're not trying to denigrate them. We're kind of a balanced, equanimous attitude that sees it all. Now, in focusing on equanimity towards all emotions, and including all emotions in our life, that doesn't mean that Buddhist spiritual life is meant to be plain or meant to be kind of, you know, unemotional, which was a criticism or a kind of a charge that Buddhists had to respond to in ancient India. There were people who learned about Buddhism and learned about the Buddha and heard that Buddhism teaches, or that it said that the Buddha was someone who attained non-passion, or the word is araga, so a-passion or non-passion, or was an unpassionate person, was attained, but went beyond passion. And the word raga, I'm choosing to translate this passion in English, because if you say, went around and said, you know, you're on a spiritual path that's going to lead you to having no passion, most people in California would say, well, forget that. I'm going to, you know, that's not for me. You know, passion is an important part of my life. And so when people heard that the Buddha was someone who had gone beyond passion, they said, well, that means if there's no passion, then the Buddha certainly had no love and no compassion. It's no metta, no compassion, because that's not possible if you have no passion. And so he was a completely kind of emotional, neutral person, neutered, emotionally neutered person, right? And so the Buddhists had to respond to that and said, no, that's patently absurd. The record of the Buddha is that he was filled with loving kindness and filled with compassion. And in fact, he's considered to be kind of attained the pinnacle of the potential, our potential for compassion and loving kindness. So in being beyond passion, he wasn't beyond this very rich emotional life. So the and so then you have to ask, you know, how do you define passion? And how the Buddhist, the word raga, which is the word translated as passion, often into English, it has a connotation of, it often is used for the word lust. So lust is less problematic. You know, we often see lust as being a problem. It consumes us. We are not in our right mind when we're filled with lust. We do things later on we'd rather we didn't do. If we can't fulfill our lust in the moment, then we're tortured by it sometimes. And it's very painful to be in the throes of lust, and you'd rather not have it. And that can be sexual lust. It can be addiction to food, to all kinds of things that we really kind of feel this addiction to or this drive for. Raga, in this connotation, this kind of passion can also be rooted in aversion, in anger, and hate, kind of a certain kind of passion of hate. And so raga in Pali, in the Buddhist language, has this connotation of something which overtakes you and you become a slave to, contracts the heart, drives you in a way that you're not in control anymore. You're not free. And that is what the Buddha has become free of, that kind of passion. You know, the Latin word for passion meant suffering. The passion of Christ was a suffering of Christ. So over the centuries, a number of words in English changed their meaning. Like the word emotion is a relatively new word to be so kind of just used in common parlance. The word, you know, 200 years ago in English was sentimental. It had the same meaning as pretty much as what we say now is the word emotion. A person was sentimental was a person who was emotional. If you had sentiments, you had emotions. We don't use it that sentiment has a different meaning now in English. To be sentimental is to be a little bit, doesn't always have a kind of ennobling feeling to it. Oh, that person's so sentimental. It's kind of dismissive of sometimes to use the word sentimental. But if you say someone's emotional, I don't think has quite the same connotation. So the word passion has the same thing. It's shifted its meaning over the centuries. But earlier, I think my understanding had much more to do with suffering, to suffer. Compassion, to suffer with. So the Buddha was someone who had a very rich emotional life. And in fact, the Buddhist path, in my experience, is a very emotional path. And I was surprised to the degree to which my emotional capacity was awakened through the practice. And primarily, it was very positive emotions, experiences of love, experiences of compassion, experiences of intimacy with others in the world around me, feelings of joy, of delight, of warmth, of satisfaction, of contentment. There's a wide range of kind of emotions. They became much stronger for me in the context of doing practice than I'd ever experienced before. In fact, one thing which maybe is not so popular to say for various reasons is that, a number of people have come to me, and I've had this experience, that the ecstasy, the bliss that they've experienced in meditation sometimes is much more satisfying, much more intense than that of an orgasm. That's saying a lot, right? For some people. And so you find out that actually meditation can provide that level of emotional intensity. That's part of the path. The Buddhism includes that as a possibility. So the path of Buddhism is very emotional. But the way that emotions are looked at in Buddhism is there isn't a categorical attitude towards emotions except in Vipassana, my understanding. The categorical attitude in Vipassana towards emotions is when you're practicing, when you're meditating or sitting or in the meditative mode, there is no emotion which is unacceptable. There's no emotion that needs to be denied or pushed away, and there's no emotion that needs to be indulged in or held on to. That all emotions can be included and opened up to in the field of awareness. There's no reason for the heart to be contracted towards any emotion. You can sit here and have desires to kill someone, tremendous anger and hate and aversion. And sitting here, this is one of the safest and appropriate places to feel that without feeling you need to censor yourself or judge yourself as being bad or wrong for having those kinds of feelings. That we allow those things to surface and be there. The floodgates of grief are opened up in this practice, and it's okay to let the grief kind of break through. The floodgates of compassion and joy. For the purposes of awareness, everything's included. How you want to act on this and what you want to do with this in your life, that's where the wisdom part comes in. Hopefully you don't want to go and act on your anger or your desire to kill someone. That'd be a very unwise thing to do. But for the purposes of awareness, this is a very permissive environment, the practice itself. You're allowed unconditional permission to feel who you are and what's going on. So on one hand, there's that accommodation, that permission, that's the categorical attitude in Vipassana practice. In Buddhist teaching, in the Buddhist path, there's no one right attitude towards emotions. But rather, emotions are looked upon as some as being healthy, helpful, and some emotions are unhealthy or unhelpful. And there's a selection of choosing to be involved in those which are helpful. And a choice is made to let go of or abandon or avoid even for those which are unhelpful. Avoiding does not mean denying or judging when things have arisen. But when there's some healthy choice involved, okay, I'll choose not to go there. I'll choose not to think about that, or I'll choose not to go, you know, watch that movie because watching horror movies just makes me feel a certain way that's not helpful. Whenever it's possible to make a choice, Buddhist path involves choosing to avoid or not indulge in unhelpful emotions. And choosing to get involved in, I'm reluctant to use the word indulge, those which are helpful. And part of the path of mindfulness is learning how to do that in a healthy way, how to make that distinction in a healthy way. Before we can make that distinction in a healthy way, it's really helpful to learn how to do Vipassana to our emotions, which is this very balanced, accepting attitude, awareness, that sees everything honestly for what it is, and learns what our relationship to our emotional life is. It's very helpful to get to know the trends, the common attitudes you have towards your emotions. When an emotion arises, how do you relate to it? Do you think this is, you judge it as being something to hold on to, something to push away, something to deny, something to be embarrassed about? as we become aware of our relationship to our emotions, we can simplify that relationship in the practice. And what we're looking for, in a sense, is an uncomplicated relationship to our emotions when we sit and practice, where it's okay to have it. It can just be there, kind of like it's floating up, as if it's impersonal. Part of the wisdom of Buddhism is to see the impersonality of so much of what we usually take as being very personal. And in seeing as impersonal, not to negate it or dismiss it or to be aloof from it, but not to be entangled with it in this complicated way in which we then take things personally and we measure ourselves and define ourselves by the presence of this. No longer define ourselves by our emotions, it turns out to be a very wise thing. In doing that, we want to give freedom to our emotions to be as they are. So it's this wonderful kind of double movement of freedom of our emotions to be as they are, at the same time as not defining ourselves by them. So uncomplicated emotions. So the Buddhist path is quite emotional. Mostly it's opening up to our emotional life as it is. When there's anger and fear and all the grief, it's to give lots of space to the arising of those. In the process of opening up the heart that way, we at the same time open up our capacity to feel all the so-called helpful emotions, the joy, the compassion, the love, and all these things. The paradox, or the irony, I guess, is that when we close our heart down to the emotions we consider unacceptable, we also close down our capacity to feel the opposite, or the wide range of emotions. So if you want to really open up to the freedom of the emotional life, we have to open up to that which we often don't want to look at. We've been held at bay and repressed for a long time. And then we have to learn the skills of how to open to that in a helpful way. And then as we do that, things will process, things will unfold, things will change for the better. Though sometimes they get worse in the short term. Working with emotions requires a lot of patience, a lot of friendliness, a lot of generosity of spirit, and hopefully some understanding of the principles of mindfulness, so that you're not the old habits of our attitude towards emotions, even when they're seemingly overwhelming, don't kick in and get the upper hand. So today we'll be focusing on this topic of emotions, and we'll be alternating some periods of sitting meditation, probably for about 35 minutes at a time. Some of them, probably most of them, will have some guided meditation as part of them, or the beginning of them. And then we'll do about the same, about 30, 35 minutes of walking meditation, which will also, I'll give you instructions for that as we go along. So we'll go back and forth between those two. And hopefully by going back and forth, one of the functions of that is to maintain a good energy as we go through the day. If we just sat all day, it'd be, you know, we'd all get kind of sleepy. Then we'll have an hour lunch break somewhere in the middle of the day. I'm undecided at this point if to give a talk at the end of the day. Usually I give a talk at the end of the day. I'm undecided because it might, like this morning, I've talked already for a long time. And I might talk a lot, kind of little bit as we go along. So then, you know, it's enough. So we'll just kind of keep practicing right up until 4:30. So we'll see how it goes. There are two bathrooms in the... on this floor, far end by the kitchen. There's also a bathroom upstairs. There's a line for that one. You can take the spiral staircase upstairs, and there's a bathroom upstairs. There is, for walking meditation, you know, you can use the hallway out there. And maybe we shouldn't use this hallway for walking meditation for this day, because maybe people like to kind of just be someplace quiet. Some people like not to walk, or for some reason this can remain quiet. And then the parking lot, if anybody is parked in the parking lot, our parking lot, maybe you can move your car, because it's nice to keep that empty for walking meditation during a day like that, like today. And some people like to walk around the neighborhood during the walking time. And so hopefully we'll find enough places to the side of the building and wherever you kind of find. I think most of you understand about the dana system, the donation system we have. There's two baskets there by the door. One basket is operations dana, which is for the operation, the running of our center. The running of our center is entirely done by the volunteer donations that people give. And we ask on a day, we suggest for a day like today, that the suggested donation is $5 to $10. Then there's a teacher dana donation basket. So if you want to make a donation towards me for the day, you can put it there in that basket. And the same way the center operates on, you know, completely the support, the livelihood of the center is on the donation operation of it. So my livelihood is also completely 98% dependent on the dana, the donations that support my livelihood. So you do that as you wish. So that's what I can think of in terms of, yes. So do you have any logistical questions for the day? Yes, please. If you have no choice in the matter, then there's nothing I can say. Right? Except that, you know, if you start doing it, then you think you're frightening people. Maybe you should get up and, you know, go outside or something, or try to stop it if you think you're, you know, upsetting people. But, you know, if it happens spontaneously and you have no choice, then there's nothing I can say. If you have some choice in the matter, then it's best in this environment not to express that kind of stuff. If you have to make a lot of noise, you have to cry. You're welcome to cry and to sob. Again, if your floor is shaking, and you know, probably it's fine to go someplace a little bit further away. But if you want to suddenly laugh, for example, some people want to laugh a lot, or if you want to just kind of yell, I don't think it's very helpful both to the group and also probably not helpful for you in this context. Probably what's more helpful is to not to exactly suppress the energy of it, but not to give into it either, but rather feel the tremendous impulse as it courses through your body. And so just, and to really, it takes a lot of strength sometimes, really to hang in there, and just stay very mindful of that impulse, and really feel what's going on in your body, that impulse, and just feel the push, the drive, and it probably would be very empowering for you to discover the capacity to be present for something, feel tremendous push and drive and demand, the insistence sometimes of a certain emotional expression, and not give into it, and just let it course through your body, and watch what happens as you do that. And what happens often is what I call riding the wave of an emotion, and it'll peak, it'll get stronger and stronger, and it'll be so compelling, and it'll feel like this, you know, it has to be now, or you're going to die, and often many people in our lives will give in to that impulse. But if you hang in there, it can feel like the rodeo sometimes. And just watch it and watch it and watch it and let it course through you. Don't deny it, don't repress it, but don't give into it. Then sooner or later, the wave will crest and break. And you'll find yourself on the other side. And it'll you know, quiet out. And you'll realize that it'll get quiet at some point. And that compelling nature of that impulse will lose its seductive quality to you. It's very empowering for people to understand, to realize that capacity. So it probably serves you better not to yell if you have a choice, but also not deny or repress it's happening exactly, but just really feel that impulse and don't give into it, if you can. If you feel like you just simply can't hold it back, then maybe open your eyes, take some deep breaths, because I think probably if you yell in here, a lot of people are going to get frightened. And it's not so good to frighten people like that. It's okay. I mean, these are mindfulness students, and you know, they're supposed to have the skills to work with it. And is that okay? Crying is, and you're welcome to cry. This is considered a very safe place to cry. And what sometimes instructions were given on retreat is, if people around you hear that you're crying, it's okay. It just opens their hearts. So that's a little bit different than yelling or screaming. Well, if you're sobbing, you know, and you don't, and, you know, it's kind of shaking the floor, And it's not going to interrupt the process by going into the next room or going outside. It's probably a kind thing to do, is just, you know, go outside and come back in a little while. We have this creaking floor, so to hear you cry and hear the creaking floor at the same time. And so hopefully that's okay. But I don't want to say that with any suggestion to inhibit what's going on, because this is supposed to be a safe place to let these things course through you. But it's really the learning how to let it course through you without giving in to something. And sometimes it can feel like the rodeo. You feel like you need to bolt, you know, just, I got to run, I got to get out of here. And it's successful meditation, the fact that you kept your butt on the cushion. And, you know, it really can feel like the rodeo. And we just open to that, allow that to be there. It's kind of like we allow everything to be as it is, all the emotions, in the container of sitting still. So it's not repression, but it's not expression either. So it's kind of the middle ground, the middle way between that. And it's really safe. It's an amazingly safe place to sit here quietly. I can feel like the rodeo, but to sit here quietly and let these emotions course through us. And it's what your emotions and your body probably most wants. It's really healing to do it. To give expression sometimes is not so healing. There's a place for expression. And sometimes I'll encourage someone to go out into the woods and emote in an expressive way, yell or something. Any other questions before we start? Oh yeah, it's a silent day except for me. So what's most helpful for a day like today is if you all keep it in silence. If during lunchtime you're here with someone and you know they want to talk with you, you know, then we ask you to kind of go a little bit further away from right in the central area here, so that your talking doesn't, you know, change the atmosphere, the feeling of it all. But I think it's most helpful on days like today. The continuity, the momentum of the practice builds the best in the context of kind of silence. Okay, another, yes. Where would expression be? Oh, not necessarily. It's not, it can be productive. That's why sometimes I send someone out into the woods when we have woods to do that. The expression of emotions sometimes can reinforce the particular forms of response. It sets up a habit. So if a person is angry, it used to be like in the 60s and 70s, catharsis was really important. And a lot of therapists encourage their clients to cathart. And catharsis brings a lot of relief. And sometimes it can bring understanding. It isn't necessarily it's always wrong. But it turned out that it was over-evaluated. Most therapists now feel like it was over-evaluated. And rather than helping people, if you cathart too much, it reinforces the tendency to get angry, if you cathart your anger. So the expression of something sometimes feeds that tendency. Mindfulness, which sees it clearly for what it is, doesn't feed it, but rather helps liberate it. Kind of the attitude of Buddhism is that, this is a little bit maybe metaphorical speaking, but in the center of everything is a seed of liberation, where everything wants to be liberated. It doesn't want to be expressed, it wants to be liberated. Liberated doesn't mean the free expression of it. Liberation means the release of it in some way. And so the mindfulness, the holding things in awareness, helps the process of liberation, liberating, self-liberating aspect of things. Expression solidifies something. So unless a person, one of the reasons to have someone express, there's a lot of places for expression. I mean, if you love someone or feel joy in someone, that's really helpful to let that become more of a habit. And so to express it, you know, I really appreciate you. It's a beautiful thing, and so that reinforces that part of us. If I say, you know, you irritate me, that can reinforce, you know, get angry and yell at someone, that can reinforce that. So we have to choose, you know, what we want to express and the time and place for it. But now I forgot the rest of what I was going to say. So that's... that's the way it goes. So, is that okay? Is that an answer? So let's start. But now, you know, it's been half an hour of sitting here listening to me. I think probably it'd be good to take a couple of minutes to stand and stretch. And if you need to go to the bathroom, some of you can go quickly. And so in meditating, it's helpful to take a stable posture, an alert, upright, stable posture. So you might take a few seconds to be careful with your posture and kind of explore what it would be like for you to be upright, alert with your spine, with your torso, and also stable. Stable with the base against your chair, the floor, your cushion. One of the classic images for meditative posture is sitting like a mountain. The image works really well with a sitting on the floor cross-legged because you're kind of a triangle. But the idea of sitting like a mountain stable becomes a great aid with emotions. You know, when the rodeo begins, when there's very strong emotions, because if you have the stability of your posture, you're composed there, then it's a lot easier to let the emotions course within. But for many reasons, it's good to have an upright posture, alert. And then it's usually helpful to softly close your eyes. Some people like to let their gaze be inward, down and in, if it's easy to do that. And since the subject of today is going to be emotions, why don't we just start directly by checking in to see what the mood you have right now. What's the mood or the emotional state that's present for you? It may be very subtle, but there's always one. There's always something going on emotionally or mood-wise, mental state or attitude. Could be anxious or contented. Could be impatient or calm. Could be happy or sad. Elated or feelings of grief. Confused or hesitant, resistant, eager. At ease or uneasy. It might be a word or some words that you have and that you can characterize your mood with. Or perhaps your mood is kind of undefinable or vague and just kind of there with a general vague sense of what's happening. And as you sit with your emotion or mood, notice if there's any tendency to identify with it, to take it personally, to let it be a way that you define yourself. Some attitude, some assigning of meaning to it. This means that I'll always be this way, or this means that this is going to be too hard, or this is going to be great, this is going to be great. Can you allow it to be just the way it is? And feel the mood or the attitude or the mental state, the emotion, how you are in your body. What areas of your body express or are activated by how you feel? Some people don't have a clue how to do this exercise of how you feel it in your body. But if you know, is it happening in your little toe? In your ankle? Is it happening more in your torso or your head? Particular areas of your torso or your arms or your hands, your shoulder? Your face, jaw, or eyes. And see if for a few moments you can be quite relaxed about what's happening. And notice what happens, how it changes as you watch it. Does your mood or emotional state change in any way? Does it get stronger, weaker? Does it fluctuate as you're just open to it? Now, it's very helpful in meditation for the mind to become stable, to become have a little bit of calm and concentration. And for this purpose, it's very helpful, it can be very helpful to stabilize the attention on the breathing. Staying with the breath for a while can for some people be a neutral place where you begin to free the mind from its normal habits of always going and thinking certain ways or reacting certain ways. Letting the mind become a little bit independent from old habits, from tendency to always be distracted or obsessed with thinking. When you turn your attention to the breathing, it can help at first to very gently, lovingly, take a few long, slow, deep breaths. And as you breathe in, to feel a connection with your body, the expansion, the pressure. And as you exhale, to let the body relax. And letting your breathing be normal. Notice how your in-breath, your inhalations, feel different in your body than your exhalations. Notice that in exhaling, part of that process is a letting go, a releasing. And it can be helpful to appreciate or enjoy that process of releasing or letting go. Each time you exhale, let go of your thoughts, your thinking. Each time you let go, appreciate the silence between your thoughts or beyond your thoughts. Breathing in mindfully, breathing out. In being mindful of the breathing, in riding the breaths, riding the sensations of breathing, as if the breaths were waves coming in and coming out, rising and falling. Stay there with the rhythm, the alternating rhythm of breathing in and out. And if there are moods or emotions or body sensations, they're coming in and pressing for attention. Continue being with the breathing. But imagine that the breath includes or embraces all that. So you don't get involved with the other things, but you don't deny them or stay unaware of them. You continue to ride the breath, the ocean of breathing, aware of the way in which that waves of breath can include or wash through whatever else is going on. When the mind wanders away in thought, and you notice that, the noticing that you wandered away in thought is a very important moment. It's a moment of mindfulness, natural mindfulness. And when that happens, invite the breathing back into your awareness. Very gently, without comment, let go of your thoughts and begin again breathing in and out mindfully. As you're staying with your breathing, if there's very small ways, easy ways, of adjusting your breathing so that it's more comfortable or more enjoyable, you're welcome to do that. Breathing a little bit more fully into parts of your body, or relaxing your diaphragm or your belly, letting the exhalation be smoother or more extended can sometimes bring more enjoyment or comfort. And if it's not easy to do that, to adjust, then don't worry about it. It's quite significant to entrust ourselves to the breath, to really trust your breathing. Breathing in, breathing out. And now become aware of what mood or emotional state is present for you, the same way you did at the beginning of the sitting. Has it changed? Is it the same? If it's the same mood as before, has it changed in intensity or in size or quality? if it's gone away and we've been replaced by something else, notice the absence of what was there at the beginning, and notice what has come instead. Is it easier now to hold it with composure, with generosity, with non-identification, not taking it personally? It's just there. Or is it harder? After sitting for a period of meditation, do you bring a different attitude or relationship to yourself and your mood, your emotional state? And then in the last few minutes of the sitting, last couple of minutes, return again to your breathing. Maybe breathe a little bit more fully. And let your breathing kind of wash through you. Wash your mind, your heart, your body. Let it have a calming influence. And then take the last, very last minute now, and using your thoughts, reflect upon what happened to you during that sitting. Kind of review it. The beginning, the middle, the end. How were you engaged in the practice during this period? And what happened to you? The practice of reviewing a meditation session can be very helpful sometimes. It's not the same thing as meditation, where there isn't that kind of reflective kind of thinking going on. But at the end of a sitting, to review something can strengthen the process of mindfulness, because mindfulness and remembering are actually closely related functions of the mind. And if you actually try to remember back over, review what happened, it can strengthen the capacity to be mindful in the moment. Also, you can learn from reviewing. You can learn a lot of things. You can learn how it went and how you engage yourself, and maybe realize, you know, well, I could have tried more. Maybe I should have tried a little bit less. I was a little bit trying too hard, or you know, I was a little bit complacent there, or you know, oh boy, you know, why did I let myself get carried away with those thoughts for 20 minutes? And that recognition of that, what happened, can then make it a lot easier when you come next time to sit, to come with a little bit more of a healthy resolve, to realize what's going on, the trends in your mind, trends in your meditation, and maybe be a little bit less willing to spend 20 minutes thinking about something, because, you know, oh, next time I think I'll take the practice a little bit more intently, be more resolved to be present and wake up. Also, we can learn from our experience. We learn, for example, a lot of things we can learn by reviewing, and a lot of the wisdom of practice comes from just understanding the processes of what happens to us. And with emotions, it's often very valuable to review a little bit. When they're gone, for example, when they pass, to recognize that they're gone. But also to review, a little bit what our attitude had been. I've been in situations where I had a certain emotion or mood. And, you know, my rational mind knows better, but my other mind relates to it as if, this is it. This is forever. This is the way it's always going to be. And how can I possibly live my life this way? And you know, how can I possibly, you know, be around other people, because you know, it's going to be this way forever. And by reviewing, you know, recognizing actually it doesn't happen that way. That the emotions arise, moods arise, they pass, they change. And it's very, very helpful to kind of not be so caught in the grips of it while it's happening. Now, to practice very simple breath meditation to develop concentration and calmness can also be very, very helpful in this process, because often when we're in the midst of the throes of our emotional life, kind of caught by it, we often take it very seriously, as if it's the whole world, it's the whole thing, everything is going on. But when the mind is calm, the strength of a calm mind, it's easier not to take the emotion as being everything, as being, you know, it's like kind of get lost in it. And we can have a different relationship to it. Oh, we kind of see it for what it is, mind is stabilized, it's certainly important, it's there, but we're not so much right in the middle of it. There's something else going on. There's a stability, there's a calmness involved in the middle of it. It's kind of like the difference between if you're in a maze and you're lost in the maze, you're kind of in it and you've been in it for days and you can't find your way out. But it turns out the maze is only, you know, half an inch or an inch above your eye level. And if you just stood on your tippy toes, you could look over the edge of the wall and see, you know, the way out, and you'd be fine. Having a little bit of calmness and concentration, it lets you kind of stand on your tippy toes, in a sense, with your mind. And you see beyond, see above it all. So you're not kind of in the midst of the maze of life, but you kind of have a little bit of overview of it all. And from the overview, it doesn't seem so bad, or it doesn't seem so entrapping, or so, you know, this is everything. I remember once when I was 20 or 21, I had a very, very happy, very ecstatic, actually, summer. Not meditating, but just doing things, other things, vacation. And I lost some perspective of it all. And I kind of thought, I said to my friend, I said, I'm never going to be depressed again. It was so powerful, the joy, and I kind of, this is it, you know. And then within a few months, I was more depressed than ever been in my life. And then it was, oh, I'll never recover. This is it. I'm depressed forever. You know, it went on for some weeks, you know, and this is it. And wasn't it. Then there was something else happened. Something else happened. So, yes, please. Sure, very close one. We'll talk about that later as we go along in the day. So let's do a period of walking meditation. And what I'd like to propose is that part of this walking meditation is that you just go for a walk. Don't do anything that looks like a Buddhist practice, particularly. I mean, don't walk in such a way that anybody would notice, you know, that you're doing some kind of practice. And there's four blocks, you know, connected to this corner here, right? So maybe just walk around the block, but maybe walk clockwise. Most people don't know that's the Buddhist direction, so it's okay. And just walk clockwise and circumambulate the blocks. Just choose your block, one of these four blocks, this one or the, you know, kitty corners. And as you walk, just walking in an easy, casual way, and be with yourself. Track what your mood, your emotions, your reactions are as you walk. And let the walking lubricate your relationship to your mood, your emotions, so that in the walking, the body walking, the steps walking, the movement of the body walking, somehow keeps you in motion, keeps you moving, so that whatever the emotion or the mood is that you're recognizing, whatever's happening, somehow begins to be more fluid. So you're really with yourself, you're in yourself, you're kind of internal in many ways during this walking time, tracking what's going on, what you're feeling. And then as you walk around, if you run into someone or some stranger or whatever's going on, notice how subtle the shift in mood, the emotions might be. Suddenly, you know, you see some huge, huge towering, you know, Goliath, you know, walking down the sidewalk. And you notice, you know, your stomach contracting, the fear. And then you notice, you know, some kid playing, and you feel the delight in that. Or, you know, you get all these changes, and the kaleidoscope of changes as you go. There might be an overarching mood. And then notice how the subtle changes, depending on you walk into a shady area after being in the sun. I don't know if that happens today, but you suddenly you feel a little more contracted. You walk into the darker place and more expansive in the lighter place. And so walk at least once around the block, maybe twice if there's time. And we'll start again in here at, now it's, I have 10:20. So let's start in here at 10:55. And so we have about 35 minutes. And so since you're walking around the neighborhood, you have to track it yourself the time. If you've walked around at least once around and you want to come back and just do regular walking meditation here and you know how to do it, then you're welcome to come back here and do that. But mostly I'm not interested in you doing regular meditation, regular walking meditation. I'm interested in you being normal, walking around in a quiet, normal way. Don't talk, but normal way. And just in that normal mode in walking, being with yourself and feeling what it's like to be with yourself, your mood, your emotions, your states, and see if in the walking, if that can lubricate and keep it fluid. Okay, is that okay? So enjoy your walk. I kind of call it my emotion meditation. And what it involves, I usually do it when I'm driving, like especially on the freeway, when I have long stretches of the freeway to go or someplace. And I'll start paying attention to my emotional responses or my emotions. The very subtle ones. I might have a general mood that I'm in for the day, kind of for a while. But there's a but I pay attention to the subtle shifts that are going on as I drive. And it's like a kaleidoscope. If it's subtle enough, I mean, suddenly there's a, you know, someone cuts me off and I get irritated. Someone pulls over to make me let me go by and I feel gratitude. And a police car comes up near too close and I feel fear. Some beautiful car drives by and I feel desire. And it's kind of constantly shifting, you know, because all this car, all this stuff is going on. And it's a constant little shift of emotions and feelings going on. And what I find useful about doing that is that because I'm tracking it, being present for it, there's much less residue. But if I don't track it, it's happening anyway. And then there's much more residue, and especially those emotions which cause stress or tension, that tension remains as a residue and builds in the course of the drive, in the course of the day. And so by the end of the day, if you have enough of this residue, enough of this little tensions that are unresolved or unrelaxed, then no wonder some people have a headache at the end of the day, if you're really tense. All from these little teeny things. But if you're actually there to track it and watch the teeny movements of emotional reactions and the tensions that arise because of it, then there's a greater chance that it kind of stays fluid. It doesn't build. There's no residue. Any other comments about the walk you'd like to make? Reports of how it was?
Yes.
Yes. No, it's very interesting. And it often it's the subtle ones that are the foundation to creating the big ones.
Yes.
Yes, Megan. So there's a kaleidoscope of emotions that can happen, and small reactions, responses, and there's big ones that kind of stay around for a while. It's interesting that in Pali, which is the Buddhist language of kind of church Latin, the Buddhist language of the Theravadan tradition, there's no word that easily corresponds to our word emotion. there's some words that kind of are sometimes used, but it's been pointed out by a number of scholars that there's no word for our word emotion. And that seems very odd because emotion is so important for us, the word. And we think we know what it is, and we have these manifestos and what to do with our emotions. And but there's no particular word for it. And what does that mean, that the Buddhists don't have emotions? You know, it's, you know, you go to Asia, to Theravadan countries, and there's a lot of emotions there that people have, pretty much the same ones as we do, seemingly. But so why isn't there no word for word emotion? And I think it's because the word emotion is a category word. It's not. It doesn't really point to anything specific, particularly. You can't point to, you know, something which is in a, you know, an emotion. You know, specifically, emotion is a category, as opposed to a thing. It's a category of things. It's a set, and the human experience can be categorized in different ways. Can be divided up into different subsets, and the way we divide up the subsets of our experience is variable from culture to culture. So, like, if the human experience is a pie, then we cut out a pie piece, and our pie piece is called emotion. That's one pie piece. Maybe the Theravadan Buddhists, they cut the pie slightly differently, and so they have a different category of what they call. And I say that so that we don't have some fixed idea of what emotions are. This is, you know, emotions are one thing. And now I know what they are. Emotions are actually, it's kind of a little bit vague what an emotion, you know, what the category of emotion is. There's a wide range of things which are included in the category of emotion. Also, the idea, if we use the word emotion, it might hide the fact that most of the things we call emotions are composite things. They're not single unitary things, but rather it's made up of many different aspects. They're made up of thoughts, some people mentioned, the thoughts that relate to them. They're made up of body sensations. They're made up sometimes with intentions, things that we want, desires. Even when there's fear, there's kind of a pushing something away or recoiling from something. It's a movement for or against things, often with emotions, and so often intentions are part of it. There's an evaluation sometimes that is part of the emotion. Without the evaluation or the assigning of meaning to an experience, maybe we wouldn't have any emotion. Someone gives you an old postcard, you know, from, it's not that old, it's not like an antique, it's an old postcard, and you look at it and say, well, you know, there's no feeling, you don't have any emotion for it. And then you're told that this postcard, you know, was, and you give some wonderful story around this, you know, what happened with this, you know, suddenly this postcard has meaning, and maybe it's very personal meaning for you, and suddenly you just feel this delight to have this in your hand. There's an evaluation, assigning a meaning to it, which is not inherent in the postcard itself. And the emotion arises not in the postcard, but it arises out of that valuation, assigning a meaning, the understanding that the mind kind of holds that postcard with. So certain emotions arise out of that evaluation, the meaning-making ability of the mind, which is not always accurate, as many of you know, right? We assign meaning sometimes, and we find out later the meaning was wrong. It wasn't that way at all. And all the emotions that we had based on that meaning then become... I don't know what to say here. They wouldn't have been that way if we had a, you know, the proper understanding of it. So one of the things we do in Buddhist practice is begin to tease apart what an emotion is. So we don't just see it as being a unitary, solid thing. And that's what we do with a lot of our experience. We begin teasing apart, looking at it very carefully, and don't take it for granted, but investigate what that experience is. And that act of investigation then becomes very important. Investigation does two things. Investigation helps you to see more clearly what's there. And investigation also, as it says in the newsletter article, it changes the ecology of your mind because you're bringing something new into the equation, investigation. So if you're wallowing in self-pity, kind of lost in its, you know, drowning in self-pity, the whole ecology of the mind is one of drowning. But then if you get interested in what's this like to wallow in self-pity, what's that like? You know, how does it feel? How does it feel around my eyes or in my shoulders or in my body? Or what's the flavor of the thoughts when there's self-pity thoughts, you know? And you And suddenly this other thing, which is not self-pity, is operating in the mind. It's adding another element to the equation of the mind, to the ecology of the mind. Something that's considered in Buddhism to be wholesome, helpful. And suddenly you have a different animal, you have a different situation going on. And the stronger the power of the investigation, the stronger the mindfulness, the stronger you're bringing in healthy attitudes, healthy factors of the mind into what before was kind of locked in, kind of unhelpful kind of state to be in. Make sense what I'm saying? So part of what we do is to at first hand, we want to learn how to be present for an emotion as it is. Not push it away, not hold on to it, not express it, not deny it. Just allow it to be there in whatever way it wants to be. And then the next thing we want to do is begin investigating it, seeing it more clearly what it is. Now, one of the things that emotions are part of the composite element of emotions that in Buddhist psychology is considered to be very fundamental, is the feeling tone of the emotion, a feeling tone of our experience. The feeling tone, the Pali word is vedana. It's sometimes translated in English just as the word feeling. It's interesting because the word feeling in English has, I think, maybe many meanings, but two primary meanings. We often refer to our emotional state as our feeling. What are you feeling now? And the kind of implication is you're feeling some emotion. But feeling also refers to the sensations you're experiencing. You know, I'm feeling the texture of the wall. What are you feeling? The texture of the wall. So feeling also refers to sensations. And that's very interesting that and it points to the close interaction between sensation and emotions and response and reactions to what's going on. And so in Buddhist English, the word feeling, unless you know, it technically refers to the sensation, the feeling tone of the sensation. And every experience, every sensation we have, whether it's sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, internal body sensations, or the sensation, the awareness, the perception of mental states and thoughts and all that, is said to have one of three flavors, tones. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, pleasant or unpleasant, neutral. And now this is a very significant thing. So everything we look at, everything we experience, everything we touch, everything we feel inside has some quality of having either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. To a great extent, the mind reacts to things being pleasant or unpleasant. We go towards what's pleasant, we hold on to what's pleasant, and we recoil or pull away or push away what is unpleasant. The pleasure, pain response. Very basic. I think Freud kind of talked about how basic this level of the mind's movements is. And sometimes we build huge philosophies, political creeds, to justify why are we simply going towards what's pleasant or recoiling from what's unpleasant. The philosophy follows the kind of amoeba-like reaction that we have. And if you want to justify, you know, so if you live in your philosophy sometimes, you sometimes miss the fact that you're actually responding to something very, very amoeba-like, very basic to human psyche. That this human psyche sometimes will go towards what it's pleasant, hold on to it, or push away or recoil from what is unpleasant. And it's fascinating, it's very significant in mindfulness practice to begin tracking how this works, to see actually this working. Usually it's a very subtle thing. It doesn't have to be subtle, but to watch it in meditation is relatively subtle. The mind has to be somewhat stable and quiet in order to see it. And there's another kaleidoscope, kind of constantly shifting to watch how we go for and against something. Some people have all these attitudes towards pleasure and pain, which kind of magnifies that reaction. If our attitude towards life is that life is only, you're only successful as a human being if you have a lot of pleasure. And somehow there's a personal failing when you feel things that are unpleasant. Then you magnify the reactivity that has. So suddenly you have some pleasant experience. Oh, you're now a successful human being. You got it. You're getting close to it or whatever. and something unpleasant's happening, it's a personal failure. Something's wrong. I have to change something. In meditation, if you feel something unpleasant in meditation experience, this means that I'm not a good meditator. I'm having a pleasant experience in meditation. This means that I'm a successful meditator. I can't wait to let my friends know. And so we exaggerate. So we feel joy because we're successful in our making a good self-image. So there's ways in which we can exaggerate the pull-push we have towards pleasure and pain. It's said that with neutral sensations, one response the mind has is confusion. It doesn't know how to respond, so it's confused. So the example is that someone comes in, say someone of you comes in here to meditate. Maybe you can recognize yourself in this. You came in here this morning to find a place to sit. And if you might just kind of very quickly scan the room and notice where it seemed more pleasant to sit, more pleasant people are sitting over in that corner. So you kind of feel kind of like, you go gravitate towards there because it's a pleasant place to sit. Or over there, that's an unpleasant place to sit. And so you feel like kind of, pulled away. You kind of avoid the unpleasant. It's very simple. It's very rudimentary, basic sometimes. Or say that you can't tell whether it's unpleasant or unpleasant in here. So you're confused. You stand there for a while and wonder, where should I sit? Kind of debating in your mind, knowing, what criteria should I use? Pleasant, unpleasant is very basic. And it's one of the building blocks for our emotional reactions. We feel something unpleasant, and there might be anger towards it. There might be self-blame. There might be fear for the in relation to that which is unpleasant. We feel something pleasant, and there might be joy. There might be delight. There might be happiness, contentment. And then if we evaluate, put meaning on pleasant and unpleasant experience, then the emotional reaction can get much more complicated. So if I experience something pleasant, and the meaning of that is that I'm a successful human being, then I feel even more happy because it's good to feel like you're a successful human being. So the emotion then builds based on the evaluation we have, the assigning a meaning. Is this making sense? Somewhat? Any questions? Can I make it clear? Yes. What should your intent be? Why are you asking that question? My intent is to try to be helpful for you. And it would be nice if that was reciprocated. It's a good question. And what's the purpose of being human being? What's the meaning of life? What's the intent that we should have? It's one of those big questions. And in terms of what I'm talking about right now, sometimes our relationship to that question can be simply a response to pleasure and pain, pleasant and unpleasantness. So, for example, if we feel kind of uneasy about life, kind of unpleasant about life, then there's a drive to try to find a solution. And one of the solutions some people try to go for is to find meaning or purpose in life in response to the aversion to things being unpleasant. But rather than looking for meaning in life, if a person turned the attention back to how we respond to discomfort, you might be able to resolve the fear and learn how to be content or be at peace or be free in the midst of the uncomfortable situation. And then there's no need to be driven to find the meaning of life because, the primary reason was simply trying to avoid something uncomfortable. Here in America, maybe I shouldn't say this, but now that I've gone this far, I guess I have to put my foot in my mouth. So we've spent a lot of time and effort and money at Marin County to create the state-of-the-art meditation center. You know, it's been to Spirit Rock. It's a beautiful place. Probably hard to find a meditation center as beautiful anywhere in the world, especially in Buddhist Asia. Beautiful place. And beautiful facilities and rooms for people. And Ajahn Amaro, when he saw it, when he first opened, he said, oh, now people will suffer more because they can't blame something else for their suffering. But it's very comfortable there, relatively comfortable. And then people come to Spirit Rock, and there's mostly single rooms there, but there's some double rooms. And now they wish they'd never made those double rooms, because it means in order for the center to be full, a certain number of people have to be assigned to double rooms with a roommate. But they know most of the other people don't have roommates. They have their own room. And so people get upset, and they get angry, and they feel like they've been discounted, and they feel, you know, that their retreat's been ruined because they have a roommate. And, you know, it's quite, you know, the poor managers have to deal with all this. So when many of us, this is what I shouldn't be saying, is comparing, right? But is when many of us went to Asia, the conditions were comparatively primitive. You know, to say it well, I mean, the conditions were often, many of us got sick, you know, all kinds of illnesses, and the food would be, you know, pretty bad. You didn't quite know what was in the food sometimes, you know, and you know, we'd be careful with the food we ate, there were all these mosquitoes, and you know, I was given this bed. One place monastery I was in for 8 months. I was given a nice, you know, bed. You know, it was a nice, you know, regular kind of size bed, but it didn't have a spring, a mattress. It was just wood planks. But they didn't expect me to sleep right on the wood planks, so they gave me one of these very, very thin kind of bamboo or straw, like beach mats they have in America. You know, that was my mattress. And, you know, conditions of cold, of wet, scorpions and cobras, and, you know, it's the heat, and our knees swell up, and sometimes we didn't get enough food to eat. And in terms of accommodations, I remember sleeping I spent a lot of time in Asia sleeping in a room with other people. Sometimes I spent one practice period sleeping with a room of 30 guys. That was, you know, every night. We ate all our meals there, we meditated there, and we slept in this one room together. You know, I want my own room, please. And then, you know, I remember in Nepal once, sleep in a little place that was just big enough for four of us to lay down our mattresses next to each other. So we were just right next to each other. And that's the way we slept for that particular time. I think it was 4 weeks together. Now, I'm trying not to say this, is saying, you know, that was the golden age of, you know, practice. But rather, there was a lot of value in putting ourselves in situations which are uncomfortable and coming to terms with that and seeing how the mind reacts and how the mind wants comfort, seeing how the mind wants to be protected and safety and wants all these things that actually in and of themselves are maybe innocent enough things to want, but they don't challenge us to find out how to let go of our attachments. So you come to Spirit Rock and it doesn't offer you the same kind of a challenge to many of the things we're normally attached to. So, and sometimes it's very simple. It's attachment to pleasure. It's a kind of attachment to not having discomfort. It's so primary. And to track this and watch how this works is one of the very, in Buddhism it said it's one of the really important doorways to freedom. Just simply to watch how the mind goes for and against pleasure and pain. It's a doorway, it's a door to freedom, because it's so primary to what goes on. There's much more to be said about emotions and freedom, but this is, it's really primary. And since the beginning of this day, I want to focus a little bit on this. So we're going to sit again. If you'd like to stand for a minute, because now you've been sitting for a little while listening, please stretch. So again, take a comfortable, alert posture. Softly close your eyes. And then straight off, become aware of the mood, the emotional state that's present for you, how you're feeling right now. And then notice whether that's pleasant or unpleasant, or neither. And how do you relate to it being pleasant or unpleasant? What's your response? Is it okay? Hold on or push away. Do you make a story about it, assigning a meaning? Scan through your body and see if you can find a pleasant sensation in your body, anywhere at all. It can be your lips touching, or your hands touching, or sensations of breathing, or temperature. Find a pleasant sensation in your body. And as you feel that pleasant sensation, notice if there's any response to it, for or against, assigning a meaning or stories or ideas about it, wishes concerning it. Notice anything that happens that's different than the very simple being present for the pleasant sensation in and of itself. If it disappears as you watch it, then find another one. Notice how your mind is, or your attitude is, in relationship to the pleasant sensation. And now, take a deep breath and let go of that. And now, find an unpleasant sensation anywhere in your body. Can be subtle or great. And let your attention be there, settle there on that unpleasant sensation. And as you do that, notice what happens for or against it, story making, meaning, attitudes. What shifts in your mind? How it is now to be aware of unpleasant. If it disappears, then find another one, unpleasant sensation. And then let go of that. And now find a pleasant sensation. maybe the strongest pleasant sensation that's available to you. It doesn't have to be that strong. And hang out with there. Let your attention settle there in the pleasant, exploring it, feeling it. And notice what shifts in your mind, if anything, in terms of for or against, meaning, texture of the mind, heaviness of the mind. Feeling pleasant. And then let go of that. And now find something unpleasant, uncomfortable in your body, in your experience. Let the awareness open to that, feel that, explore it, sense it. And notice how your mind, your presence, what shifts and changes. If the reference point is the potential to be present for it in an uncomplicated way, without any for or against, just free-floating, as if it has nothing to do with you, just a sensation, kind of neutral in a sense. Notice what you add to the experience of being present for the unpleasant. What happens in your body as you're present for the unpleasant? And then let go of that. And then begin being aware of your breathing. Breathing in mindfully, breathing out mindfully. And then being with the breath, feeling your breathing, what it's like in your body to breathe. Become aware of the pleasant and or unpleasant qualities of the breath. And then notice your response, your reaction to the breath being either pleasant, unpleasant, comfortable, uncomfortable. Do you do anything about it being this way? If the reference point would be a mind that does nothing, just allows things to be as they are, like you're a naturalist, just studying it, letting things be. No for or against. What effect does pleasant and unpleasantness have on your psyche, your mind? Feeling the pleasantness and unpleasantness of the breathing. It could be very subtle here, but just can you discover how to be equanimous about it? Not for or against, just letting it be as it is. Not making anything of it. Not attached to it being one way or the other. And then stay with your breathing. Let it be the center of gravity where your mind settles. But if anything else happens in your experience, anything grabs your attention or pulls your attention, thoughts or feelings or emotions or body sensations or sounds or smells or whatever it might be, It's okay. Let your attention become aware of those things. And notice very simply whether the sensations are pleasant or unpleasant. Or neither. And in noticing whether they're pleasant or unpleasant or neither, how does that affect you? Is there very subtle reactions to it being either pleasant or unpleasant? Let this be a period of discovery, how it is for you, rather than some idea of what it should be, how you should be. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Whatever you're experiencing, notice if it has these qualities. If you get caught up in your thoughts, notice if they're pleasant or unpleasant. Not so much the content, perhaps, but just the quality of that thinking or the content. Notice if you react, not to the content per se, but to the pleasant and unpleasant quality of those thinking, those thoughts. You can always come back to your breathing and rest there for a while. If you find it helpful to stay present, you can label each experience you're aware of as being either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then as a continuation of this exercise in pleasant and unpleasantness, I'm going to recite a list mostly of different emotions, different words. Say them out loud. And then as you listen to these words, take them into your body, into your psyche and mind. Notice pleasant and unpleasantness. Notice how you respond and react to that. Are there common tendencies? What happens in your body? Joy. Contentment. Danger. Grief. Delight. hair. Happiness. Anxiety. Appreciation. Calm. Restlessness. Ease. Fear. Love. Tenderness. Guilt. At-homeness, feeling at home. What did you notice in response to those words? Were there pleasant and unpleasant experiences? Were there movements for or against, contractions or expansions? Stories, ideas kicked in? And then please come back to your breathing. And please be very matter of fact. Breathing in, breathing out. Letting the waves of inhalation, exhalation wash through you. So then spend the last minute of the sitting reviewing that sitting the best of you can, without straining to do so, just a very relaxed way, thinking it over, the experience of being with pleasant and unpleasant, what was difficult, what was easy, how you reacted to it all. So, I think sometimes it's quite humbling to become aware of how our reactions to life can be so basic as simply going towards pleasure and avoiding displeasure or uncomfortable unpleasantness. And so much is based on this very simple phenomena. So what did you learn? What would you like? What was it like to do that? What did you discover? So the question would be, how do you take care of your body? How do you move without it being an aversion to discomfort? Or so rather, just a wisdom. You know that what your tendency is. It's uncomfortable, and you know that in a wise way you should move. And, but so there's the movement for or against in the mind. There's a movement of wisdom. Saying, oh, I need to move. That. Right. Hating the cold. Yep. Did you discover when you went back and forth with pleasant and unpleasant and different things, did you notice that you had common reactions or responses to pleasant and unpleasantness? What did you discover about that? That it wasn't inherent in pleasant and unpleasant, but had to do with the way you responded. Yeah. You know, there is this expression in English called the acquired taste, that certain things can be unpleasant in and of themselves, but then we kind of hang in there with it, and we, through associations and, you know, whatever we use, we eventually get to like it. So, I mean, I found that was true for beer. You know, when I first had beer as a teenager, how could anybody in their right mind drink it? It's like, you know, like cold pee or something. And with coffee, I had the same reaction. I mean, for a few times, like, God, I mean, they're drinking dishwashing water. It was just, you know. And then, you know, it's acquired taste after a while. You know, now there are times where I can enjoy these things like beer. Or, I don't drink much beer now, but I came to a point where I could enjoy it. And but in and of itself, there's something in and of itself which is unpleasant. But there's something else that makes it pleasant. When I was, story I tell is when I was in Davis, going to school there, I would ride in the morning to school in the wintertime with a Thule fog in my bicycle. And I wasn't smart enough to have gloves. And I would come to school, and my hands would be so cold, I couldn't hold my pen in classroom because it took a while for my hands to thaw. And so it was very biting pain. And I used to bike to campus that way, and I'd feel miserable and have self-pity and, you know, all these wonderful, painful kind of associations and ideas. And I thought it was a really unpleasant experience in and of itself. And then but suddenly I had a flash of insight riding my bike one day the insight was the sensations I had in my hand, the biting pain, were exactly the same sensations I had in my hand when I was a teenager and used to go skiing and it was cold. But when I was skiing, it was part of the exhilaration, part of the delight and the joy. Same sensations in the hand, but a different association. And I realized how much of the experience of the painful hands was intensified. It wasn't an unpleasant sensation in and of itself. I'm not going to deny it was unpleasant. But there was such a big layer of story making, interpretations, and associations that tied into it, that that's where a lot of the intense and pleasant it was, not in and of the experience in and of itself. part of the opportunity with starting to notice the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experience, the raw experience, the basic, raw, primary experience of things, is we can begin noticing what we add to it. And what we add to it often is not necessary. And that's why we can see the door of freedom. We can leave things at the primary level, and we don't have to add suffering or clinging or attachment or all these other things on top of it, which sometimes make things more unpleasant. It's like I used to have knee pain, and then horrified anxiety would arise, and I would tense up around the pain, and then it would hurt more. Physically, I hurt more, because I was tensing. The way we react affects our experience. Is he following me? So the whole world of emotions, to understand them, we need to also understand how primary our response is to pleasant and unpleasant. And to see that. If we don't see that, then we might be operating at a very, more abstract, more removed level. There's tremendous insight available when we see that very primary point of pleasant and unpleasant. And then how we build sometimes whole emotional worlds based on that. So that's it for the morning. And so we'll take an hour for lunch. And So one of the reasons that it's important to become aware of emotions is so we can become aware of the effect that emotions have on our life, on how we see world. The Buddha said that if you take a basin of water, a body of water, and you're going to look at your reflection in the water, if you put red dye or green dye or mud or something into the water and you try to see your face, you're not going to see a true reflection of what's there. It's like in modern language, we'd say, if you put on rose-colored glasses, then you see a rose-colored world. And in order to see clearly what's there, the water needs to be pure, it needs to be clear. And then you can see clearly what's there, see yourself clearly. And emotions have the effect of coloring the way that we experience the world and see the world. And we'll make conclusions about all kinds of conclusions that are not inherent in the situation, but are very much influenced by our predisposition, of our emotional predisposition. So sometimes I do an exercise, a guided meditation with people, and I ask them to imagine themselves in a in some lovely situation. They've been a lovely day, it's just the right, really comfortable, warm temperature, and beautiful blue sky, and springtime, and beautiful meadows, and wildflowers, and they've gone on a beautiful hike, and just the right amount, they're not exhausted, but they're quite refreshed by it, and they have sit underneath a beautiful oak tree, and they had just the right amount of lunch, not too much, just the right amount, and they're very comfortable, and they lay down, and they just kind of drift off into a nice little nap. They wake up a short time later, and everything's right in the world, very relaxed, very at ease. And then I ask people, and imagine yourself in that state, and then you turn to your friend who's laying in the grass next to you, and you just volunteer a lie to your friend. You lie. And how would that feel, to lie in that kind of circumstance? And most people will say something like, well, when I'm that calm and settled and content and at home with myself, it feels like a violation to myself to lie. In the same way, then take that image away and you take a different image of yourself in rush hour traffic on the freeway, and it's big accident up ahead, and traffic is not even moving, and all the cars are on, and the fumes are blowing in, and it's a really hot day, and your air conditioning doesn't work, and your windows are down, and some guy manages to cut you off anyway, even though no one's moving, and you're late for this really important, meeting, which, it's, the consequences of not making to it are just awful, and you're afraid of what's going to happen to the rest of your life if you miss this meeting, and you can't get anywhere, and and the person behind you is honking her horn, and you know, it just, and then one more person kind of cuts you off, and it's just so easy, kind of just to do something with your middle finger, and you know, it's just like almost automatic, and you hardly feel the pain of that because you're so stressed out and so angry and frustrated and afraid that that it just, you know, what you do with one little finger is kind of a, you know, is pretty minor compared to all the agitation you're feeling. And so the mood we're in, the state we're in, has a big effect on our ethics, I mean, what we're willing to do and what we're not willing to do. It's a lot easier to be unethical when you're all stressed out. But also our mood, our emotional state, then affects how we see things. Aversive people have a lot of aversion, will go into a situation and they'll see everything that's wrong. People who have a lot of desire might go into a situation and see all the things that they want, all the things that are going well. People who have a lot of fear will see everything as being a threat, see, ready to see threat to all kinds of situations where there's no threat at all. People who are ready to take everything very personally, see everything in terms of themselves. Maybe they have a personal hole or sense of lack or sense of insufficiency or something. And so everything is measured against that feeling of insufficiency. And so whatever they pick up in the environment, they're ready to read it. How does this relate to my insufficiency or whatever? Our mood, our emotional state, our inner life has a big impact on how we respond to the world and how we see the world. And one of the reasons to become mindful of our emotions is to become aware of how we're being influenced, how we're being biased in how we see things. You might still see it that way, but then you might see, oh, the world's a threat. But then you know from your mindfulness, I'm feeling fear, and I have this interpretation of the world's a threat. I don't know whether it's a threat or not. I'll keep my eyes open in case it is. But chances are, I've done this, you know, 95,000 times before, and thought it was a threat and it wasn't. So part of the function of mindfulness is to add a question mark at the end of our emotions and the conclusions we make by our emotions. Is this really the way it is? Are the conclusions really the way it is? It isn't saying it isn't that way. It's always putting a question mark. Is this the way it is? With the possibility maybe it's not. Maybe it's different. It makes a world of difference to have a question mark at the end of stuff than it is to kind of, this is the way things are. I know. This person really treated me awful. They did the worst possible thing, and I'm just angry at that person who was so disrespectful. Versus, that felt really disrespectful, and then a question mark. You know, maybe. Let's find out what's going on here. So much of suffering in the life actually arises out of false interpretations of what's going on. So the exploration of emotions becomes important. And in the exploration of emotions, what we discover is that emotions, for the most part, are composite events. They're made up of many different factors and events. And as we become aware of the different elements that make up a particular emotion, then it's easier to not be caught up by the interpretations, the idea, the power of that emotion that it has on us, the influence. The mind in Buddhism is not a thing. Human being is not a thing. It's an activity. The mind is an activity. And so it's constantly in action. It's constantly moving and flowing and changing and doing. And it's changing and evolving based on the conditions that influence it, that feed it. And with the conditions change, then the activity changes. And conditions are always changing. If we're aware of how external conditions change and how we react and respond to that, then we have some ability to be decisive, have some choice about how we allow the mind to flow. If we're not aware of how we take on the conditions of the world, then it can seem like we're victims of fate or victims of whatever's going on, that we were preordained that this is going to be our reaction. If you're in some horrible situation and someone yells at you in a horrible, angry way, and you feel afraid or you feel angry in return, it might seem that that's preordained, that's the way it should be. That, of course, if someone's yelling at you, you should get angry. or afraid, or whatever your response would be, is not preordained. It depends on how you receive those conditions, and then how you choose to respond in return. Anger or fear is not an automatic built-in part of nature. It's a choice that we make to respond a certain way. And part of the function of mindfulness is to place us in that point of choice so we can make wise decisions, not repressed ones, not denying ones, but wise decisions about what we choose to pick up and how we want to respond. So the emotions are composite things. When you say, you know, I'm angry, and that's all you know is you're angry, or you're happy, and that's all you know that you're happy, it's kind of like saying that you know what a painting is because you know the title. If you know the Mona Lisa, I know the title. So now, you know, I know what it is, right? You don't really know the Mona Lisa, but on the title, you have to actually study all the different elements of the painting and the color and all things. So in the same way with emotions, if you, just because you know that it's anger, doesn't mean you know much about the emotion. And part of what we do in mindfulness practice is to begin exploring what are the different elements that make up this experience. One of the elements we talked about this morning is the very basic aspect of pleasant, unpleasant, and our relationship to the pleasant and unpleasant. And that can function at all kinds of levels. It can function at the micro level, and it can function at the macro level. We can have this macro kind of bad experience, rush hour traffic that's all blocked up. It's an unpleasant experience. How do we relate to that big macro unpleasant catastrophe? It can happen at the micro level. We're sitting here and we feel a little itch, a teeny little itch someplace. And it's an unpleasant sensation. How do you relate to that? It doesn't matter what the experience is, but what do you relate to? How do you respond? Is one of the elements of what makes up an emotion. Another important element of emotions is that they're bodily. They involve sensations in the body. I would say, I would argue, or at least my view is that all emotions have bodily expressions as part of them. There's something in a body happens. William James said something like, if you didn't have a body, you wouldn't know if you had an emotion or not. Because it's the bodily experiences that tell you the emotion is there. So, you know, if you feel angry, you feel a tightening someplace, or heat, or pressure. If you feel love, you feel kind of soft and bubbly or tingly or something wonderful. There are bodily sensations directly connected to the emotion. This is pretty standard. You find a lot of psychologists talking about this too. In Buddhist practice, it's very important to start recognizing the physical side of an emotion so that we can ground our attention in the emotion, we can feel it and be present for it without getting caught up in the story. Because mostly what feeds emotions, and a big part of where emotions originate, is not in external conditions, but rather the story making we have about the presence of that experience. And some of you probably know you can have an emotion that has nothing to do with what's happening in the external world. You're sitting here peacefully minding your own business in meditation, and suddenly you have a memory about something that happened 20 years ago, and you get angry. Or I've gotten angry at things that I think are going to happen. I have no idea whether they're going to work out that way, but I have this fantasy that things are going to happen that way, and then I can feel the energy and the tightening inside of me and the upwelling feeling, and, you know, I'm all, you know, rallying the forces, you know, to take care of this. It's just a pure fantasy. I'm capable of having an emotion based on, you know, a figment of my imagination. Do some of you have the same experience? And so mostly a lot of emotions arise out of story making. And if we stay connected to the story making part of the mind, then we tend to, it's very easy to get caught up in cycles of more and more stories and reacting and responding and doing that. But we want to stay present for the emotion without getting caught and lost in the story making part of the mind, relationship to it. And one of the ways to do that is to feel how the emotion is felt in the body, to drop down into the body and experience it there. The bodily experience of emotion is always something that's in process. the body is not a thing in Buddhism. It's an activity. The muscle is, in a sense, you know, you say there's a muscle in a sense, but the muscle is constantly in activity, unless it's frozen and locked in place. But a natural motion is constantly moving and flowing and tightening, contracting. The body, from a Buddhist perspective, is seen as an activity, meaning that if we have an emotional response, and the bodily aspect of that is something which is moving. The word emote means literally, in the etymological sources of the word, to move out. The emotion, motion. It's in motion. And it's a lot easier to allow the natural processing of movement of an emotion to occur if we drop down and feel it in the body. Also, the body is, for most people, a much more neutral place to feel an emotion than the story-making part of the mind. It's a lot safer to feel your emotion in your body. The body is always in the present moment. So you know you're in the present moment when you're in your body. If you're trying to be aware of emotions and you're thinking a lot and story-making, then you might hardly be in the present moment at all. You might be still fantasizing about the future. To drop down into the body and let the food of attention, the nourishment of our awareness, flow into experiencing what's actually happening in the present in the body, allows that food to nourish that which is helpful. If the food of awareness flows into more story making, it feeds continual story making. So one of the reasons why we emphasize the body so much is to drop out of the story making but still learn how to be present for the emotion in a very direct way. Does that make sense? Any questions? Yes, Julie. Mm. So this, it sounds like the story creates the emotion. I think there are two. I'm not an expert on emotions in terms of, you know, what psychologists have been studying. There's a whole science of and different theories about emotions. I've read a few books, and there's all different kinds of theories, different theoreticians about what an emotion is and how it works. And so maybe no one really knows. This is a little bit tangential, but yesterday we did a one-day sitting here, and we were talking about joy at the end of the day. And I was merely going ahead talking about joys, if I know what I'm talking about. And then it came up that, what's the definition of joy? I was completely stumped. And I went home and looked it up in the dictionary. And the dictionary definition was circular. Basically, it said something like, joy is experience of, you looked at it too, is gladness. It's to be, yeah, you know, you look up gladness and it says, you know, it's experience of joy. So why am I saying this? So, you know, story making. So I was going to say there's in Gill's theory of emotions, there are primary emotions and secondary emotions, and primary emotions are those which don't come from a story, but if you're standing on the edge of a cliff, I think a lot of people just feel fear, or if suddenly a car kind of comes 70 miles an hour directly at you, then you know, fear is an appropriate response. It's a very gut reaction. And there's a number of very gut kind of responses that seem very primary, very immediate. They don't necessarily go through the normal story-making processing of the mind, the evaluations of the mind. There's another category of emotions called secondary emotions, which are evaluative in nature. They come with some evaluation, some story-making, some assigning a meaning. And probably for most of us, a huge percentage of the emotions we feel in the course of a day belong to that secondary level of emotions. They're not primaries. Not that often the mountain lions are ready to jump at us. But we feel a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety. And that fear and anxiety often comes from the story-making capacity of the mind or the underlying belief system of the mind. The world is out there to attack me all the time. And so part of what we want to do in practice is to also question our cognitive belief sets, the story-making capacity. See the connection between story-making and the emotion. And you'll see it very clearly as you continue with mindfulness practice. Sooner or later, you'll notice very clearly that you'll see how a thought arises in the mind, And then you'll see following that thought is an emotion. And you know, suddenly you're thinking about the future and fear. Suddenly the memory of the past, anger. Suddenly a fantasy about some sexual fantasy about someone, some wonderful fantasy about some person, and all this energy begins rising up in the body. You thought you were sleepy, but suddenly you're very awake. And you can see that connection between a thought and an emotion. Sometimes you'll see it the other direction. You'll see there's an emotion first, seemingly first, and that emotion then gives rise to certain kinds of thoughts. So say that you're afraid, maybe for good reason originally, and you go into a situation and you're ready kind of to think, oh, that person. You know, and you suddenly the mind starts making thoughts, think thoughts and stories about that person because you're predisposed to be afraid. Thoughts about how that person is threatening. So to watch that relationship between emotion and thoughts and emotion can be very liberating because you don't have to believe it then. If you can see it. If you don't see the difference between them, then it can also be all be kind of one big kind of package, and it can seem very believable. So again, one of the values of mindfulness practice is to become quiet and sensitive enough to see that difference. So I would say that most of our emotions that we experience are what I call secondary emotions. What do you think of that, the rest of you? Does that seem to go along with that? Yes.
Yeah, I kind of experience that, but then also sort of this other level, which it seems like sometimes the emotion, especially when it comes in very quickly, it's not so much about a thought, it's more just about maybe it's your mood state, but like a level of, like maybe it might be the time of the month and the hormones or something, but it's like an identical situation. One day it would be, oh, you know, my kids are climbing all over me and it's fine and I'm happy and it's delightful. And then another day, the same situation could occur and I would be like, get me out of here, this is awful. And that seems to more have to do with like the level of how quickly aversion might come in or something. And it might not even be that there's a story there so implicitly. But it's more just like the aversion seems primary. And then the story might be like, oh, I should be, don't deserve this, or I should be able to get a babysitter or something else.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, there's so many parameters that how they all feed into each other is part of what we become aware of. But you know what you describe now, I mean, it's pretty common for someone who feels all stressed out for some reason, and then the same situation in which the day before they were equanimous about, today they're all upset about, and so they don't see it. You raise the issue of hormones. Who knows all the different influences on our mood and our emotions? It isn't always. Maybe we should have a third category besides primary and secondary, besides the mountain lion and our story-making ability. There's, hormones and food and, other things that might have an effect. And so then how do we hold that when we see it? And part of the function of mindfulness is to help us not be influenced unduly by the states that are there. Yeah, Steve. Right. One of the primary stories we make is around the self, who I am in relationship to it. And another important aspect of mindfulness practice is to learn to disidentify from the emotions or the story making, the thought flow of the mind. Have you ever had the experience of being lost in your thoughts? You didn't know it, but you were lost in your thoughts. And then at some point you woke up, and you can see, you're still thinking, and the flow of thought was going on, but you were the watcher, the observer, watching that flow of thoughts. Have you ever had that experience? Who are you? Are you the thoughts, or are you the watcher? I think, you don't have to answer that, but I think the tendency when you're lost in your thoughts is identification that your thoughts and you are the same is really strong. It's kind of, that's kind of the operating mode we're in. When you become the observer, or the observation is going on, you step outside of that flow of thoughts, it's really a miraculous moment to see that the thoughts don't have to be you. And that lends itself to all kinds of opportunities. One is, don't take it so personally. You know, you have some horrible thought, and, you know, it's just the conditions of life, it's the mind. So not to take the mind as a personal thing. The mind is a process, an activity, which it can be seen almost as if it's outside of yours, it belongs to someone else. It's just something there. You don't have to take it so personally. This everything, every movement of the mind doesn't have to be some statement about who you are. And that's very freeing. Every story the mind makes doesn't have to be taken to be a true story. You don't have to live in that place. Yes. Uh-huh. Oh, this is right. So you're saying that emotions are motivating, and therefore they're justified. No, but wasn't that almost the implication? Or they have an important role in our life. Emotions are a very, very important part of our life. It's been said that part of our ability to understand life, understand ourselves, part of the way we process our experience of life and way our intelligence works is through our emotions. It's a part of the processing process. If we didn't have any emotions, we wouldn't be human. We wouldn't be able to understand very well this life that we're living. But then the emotions are also motivating. This is beyond just helping us understand. So people, it's very common for people to raise their hand and say, if I give a talk on anger, and they raise their hand and say, well, I think anger has a really important place because it motivates me and I can get things done. I can fight injustice. If I have a deadline, I can suddenly, I can do a lot of things, a lot of energy. And I feel really sad when I hear this. I agree with them. It's true. But I feel sad. And the reason I feel sad is that I believe that there are other emotions which can motivate us, but to be just as much energized to do things that don't involve this painful experience of anger. Compassion, for example, to see what the suffering of the world, the suffering maybe that the government makes, for example, and respond out of compassion can be very effective. Compassion is motivating. And the advantage of compassion is that it doesn't have some of the deleterious effects of anger. Anger is often alienating. It tends to add to conflict rather than remove it. It tends to reinforce anger in ourselves. Anger also tends to influence our perception of, we can't see very accurately when we're angry. So we don't really know if we're doing the right thing because we don't really see. So I think we need to be very careful about how we use our emotions as motivators and try to be wise about what we allow to be motivating and what not. So what I'd like to do is to do a try to see if we can explore a little bit the emotions in our body and how our body feels about them. And so let's, if you want to stand now, we've been sitting for a while, stand, stretch, loosen up your... So sitting upright, sitting quietly, closing your eyes. And then very directly, becoming aware of your body. Very matter-of-factly, as if you're a naturalist out in nature, just there to discover what it's like in nature. Very matter-of-factly, become aware of your body. Don't try to change anything or make anything happen now as you sit down. Just sit quietly and let your attention roam around your body as if it's not your own body even. Miraculously, you've sat down and you closed your eyes and you popped over into someone else's body. And you've never had a chance to experience someone else's body before. And isn't that something? And so what is this person's body like? You're not going to change anything now because you just want to find out. So use your roam around and feel your body. Noticing how you feel right now, the emotion or mood that you have, and how that is manifested in your body as energy, as sensations. And then notice what the strongest sensation is in your body that's related to your emotional state, to emotion or mood. And then bring your attention to that part of your body and very gently feel it and sense it as if awareness is a soft cotton gauze that you're very gently going to just tap, touch, feel, sense that part of your body. And then find out what sensations characterize whatever mood or mental state you have. It might be very subtle. It might be a broad feeling over big expanse of your body. It might be a very precise feeling in a particular muscle. Is it sensations of tightness or looseness, warmth, coolness, pressure, softness, hardness? Energy, vibration. How big of an area of your body is affected by this emotion or mood that you might have? Be very allowing of it. Just feel it. Drop down into your area of your heart, the heart center area, sternum area, and feel what sensations are there. Even if you feel very little there, it's okay. Just feel that part of your body. Feel it there. And as you feel sensations in that part of your body, are there any emotions that are related to those feelings, those sensations? And if there are, be very allowing both the feelings and the sensations. And take refuge in the sensations. Just feel the sensations as if they have permission to be there. As if awareness is a wide, vast screen upon which the sensations can do whatever they're going to do. Move or expand, contract, get stronger or weaker, vibrate. And drop your attention down into your stomach. And feel whatever sensations you feel there. Are there any obvious emotions or feelings you have connected to those sensations? And then feel the sensations of your back. Are there any emotions? There may, might not be. It's okay if there's none. But are there any, since any emotions connected to the sensations of your back? Shoulder blade area, spine. Let go of the story making and just feel this physicality of the emotion, of the sensations. Become aware of the sensations of your neck. Explore your neck a little bit, throat area, neck. Allow it to be as it is. And are there any emotions or feelings connected to the sensations of your neck? If there are, allow it to be that way. Feel the sensations. Explore them. Rest in the sensations, not in the reactions or story making. And then you bring your attention to your face, jaw, mouth, nose, eyes, forehead, feeling the sensations there as they are. And are there any emotion, feeling, that seems to be manifested through those sensations? And then check in again overall. How are you feeling? What's the mood or the emotional state that you're in? There's no right or wrong way to be. Just how are you? And overall, how is that manifested in your body? And very quietly, very softly, continue breathing. But breathe into or through or with the physical manifestation of your mood or mental state. And then pay attention now, what happens in your body. Notice the shifts in your body sensations, in your emotions, the expression of those emotions in your body. Would I tell you what we might be doing next? And that is, we might be turning to a person next to you, sitting facing them and look them in the eyes deeply, and then talk to them about your deepest fears. Anticipating such an exercise, what happens in your body? What do you hold on to? Is there any holding, gripping, resisting to the flow of feelings and emotions? Any thoughts, judgments, story making? And then take a couple of deep breaths and let go of all of that. And then very matter-of-factly, begin again with your breathing. Feeling your breath in and out. Settling yourself on each breath, letting go with the exhalation. Letting the breathing have a calming effect on the body and mind. If you were going to choose one emotion that had the greatest power over your life, greatest hold on you, what emotion is it that has the greatest hold? What does it feel like to have that emotion when it's there? Where in your body do you experience it and feel it? If there's a place in your body where you tend to feel this emotion, rest content to keep the awareness in that part of your body. Just feel it there. Staying with what's physical, staying with the sensations, naming them, feeling them, staying present, noticing what happens as you stay with the physical. Stay in your body. Stay in your body with the breath or sensations of your body, as if your body is your best friend, as your guide, putting aside stories and ideas and thoughts. Be with your breathing, be with the sensations of your body. Let them unfold as they wish. Let the awareness flow as it wishes in the body. Sometimes when you feel carefully your body, you can feel how you brace yourself against life. Hold yourself. If it's possible, as you exhale, to soften the holding. stay in your body. And then in the last minute or so of the sitting, review what the sitting was like. Review, think a little bit about what your relationship is to your body and in what your relationship is to experiencing your emotions in your body. So, is anyone who would like to share a little bit with what that was like? Be able to follow your emotions through your body and feel the sensations of connected to the emotions. So you'd have a thought, and then there'd be a fear in your stomach, and then when the thought goes away, there's a residue that would last maybe a minute or so. Good. It's a good observation. Most people don't have a chance to unwind much of the residue, or maybe 99.9% of the residue disappears, but 1.1% remains, and that becomes accumulative over time. And 0.10%, you know, over a lifetime becomes greater and greater. And so the Buddhist tradition talks about the accumulation, what we accumulate over time, and that some of the process of practice is a purification of what we've accumulated, letting go of some of the tensions and holding patterns that built up slowly over a long time. So emptying ourselves of the traces of the residue. Could you see the difference between, again, being in your thoughts with emotion and being in your body with it? Which felt more comforting for you? To be within your body, your emotional body, or be in your emotional thoughts? Yeah, I apologize for those of you who this has been an emotional roller coaster. And especially the little piece about we might be turning to the person next to you and sharing your darkest secrets. And did that change your body sensations? It seemed like maybe it was like too cheap of a way to get to make a point. I apologize. Woke you up. So the tremendous, you know, thing about the body is this, your body is a really good friend. It's one of your best friends if you know how to be mindful of it and use it and be present for it. It's really great. Let's take half an hour to do some walking. It's almost 2:30, so let's be back at 3. And again, I'd like to recommend you for the walking time is you do similar to this morning where you just walk around the neighborhood, clockwise perhaps if you like. Maybe go a little bit further down to El Camino, where it's really more interesting down there. And watch the traffic when you cross the street. You know, please be careful. And as you go, you know, walk normally, more or less. And as you're walking, do a few things. Keep going an ongoing labeling, noting of what you're emotionally feeling. And you might have one primary mood or emotion, but then pay attention to all the subtle variations that happen, you know. I mean, suddenly, you know, a car comes down the road and you feel some apprehension. And so name it, you know, fear. And just kind of make an ongoing, kind of slow, easygoing naming of what's happening. If you can't think of anything new that's happened emotionally, just repeat the same name for what's still there, what's there. And if you don't know what to say, say confusion. You know, that's an emotion of sorts, it's confusion. And then if you know, you're getting bored with doing this, then boredom. If you can't find anything and get irritated, you can say irritation. Just whatever's going on, just name it. Just ongoing naming of it. And an ongoing naming of this, how that feels in your body to have that tightness, warmth, softness, pleasantness, unpleasantness, contraction, expansion. So name it in your. So two things you do is you name the ongoing feel emotion, and then the corollary in the body, what it feels like in the body. Just walk around the neighborhood, kind of maybe doing whatever you can so you can stay in touch with that realm, keeping the ongoing commentary
of the labeling going to keep you on track. And just kind of enjoy the kaleidoscope of emotions, the subtlety of emotions, walking around. Maybe, you know, whatever way you want. If you want to do the advanced course, you go down to El Camino. And, and then we keep track of the clock so you can come back. So we start again at 3. We're waiting for people to come back. What was that like to do that walk? So one of the suggestions in the Buddhist tradition is that it's very helpful when you're able to disidentify from your emotions. It doesn't mean denying them. It doesn't mean avoiding them or disowning them or remaining aloof from them. It has very simple meaning of no longer using the emotions as a way of defining who you are. So if anger arises, you're not then worried that other people are going to see you being angry because that's going to characterize you as a bad person. Because that's what you're being defined by the anger. You're defining, or you're thinking other people are defining you that way. Or if you feel just a lot of joy, then we define ourselves with that joy. It's, oh, good. I really want people to notice that I'm happy because that's my true nature. And then they'll really see who I really am. And it's really important. And they better see me right now. I'm still happy. and then we just kind of take the life out of it, right? Because we're holding on to it so much. So to not define ourselves by our emotions, to not identify with the emotions, to not take them personally, is very helpful. So the question I have for you is, what have you found helpful in learning or in your ability not to take your emotions personally, not to identify with them? Yeah, what have you learned that helps you not identify with your emotions? Yes. So feeling the universality of the emotions, that you're feeling joy or fear or anger or discouragement, and it's just billions of people out there are probably going through the same, billions of moms going through the same, you know, haven't gotten enough sleep and whatever. And so it's not so personal when you realize it comes with the human condition. Right. Yes. Identified with one of them, then something had to die the next second. You had to let go of something. On retreats, there's a phenomenon some people experience. We go 10-day retreat where the first day of the retreat might be really difficult and they're tired and from all their busy lives or whatever, and they feel so awful and they can't get concentrated, and they say, oh, poor me, and I can't believe I signed up for a retreat. What was I thinking of? It's going to be forever, 10 days, and oh, poor me. And the next day, they kind of get their rest, and they feel kind of calm, and it's relatively easy to stay with their breath, and wow, this is great, I'm calm, and boy, I've got it made, I'm a good meditator, and you know, I think I should pay for one of my relatives to do this, and when can I sign up for the next retreat? This is really great. The third day happens, it's like up against a wall, you know, of fear, you know, you didn't know there was so much fear inside of you, and boy, you're just reeling in fear and worry and anxiety, and oh my God, you know, why did I sign up for this retreat? And these teachers don't know what they're talking about, and these people I'm sitting with, you know, who are these bozos? And then the next day, the fear drops away, and then you feel not just calm, but you feel tremendously peaceful joy. You never, sublime kind of peaceful joy. You never experienced it so much peace and joy before. I got it made. This is it. I've arrived. And all these beautiful people around me, it's just look at them, you know. You feel so much compassion and joy in them, and all those, you know, great teachers, you know. And then the next day, and sooner or later, someone will catch on. It's always changing. And then seeing that things are always changing is one way not to identify so strongly with them, not to take them so personally. And you see, people who've been on retreats a lot and know the cycles, they're much more gracious about the cycles. Say, oh, it's like that today. Oh, it's like this meditation's like that. Oh, it'll change again, and I've been through these cycles before, and there's this ease, and kind of they kind of float with it much more than, oh my God, this is it, you know, this is whatever, make some great conclusion about it. So that's change. What else? What else helps you not to identify?
Yeah. Forging ahead with what has to be done and not letting them limit you.
The emotion or the experience sometimes can help with a disidentification. Because sometimes our evaluations, our story making is optional, just not necessarily even accurate. And so being creative and maybe thinking about more useful stories. And the story, you know, that is like you had, which is a very good one, very wise one, you know, there's all these other mothers and all over the world having the same thing. It's not so personal, just not just me. It just comes with motherhood. That's a story. You know, it's a useful, it's maybe a truer story than what you used to have, but it's still kind of reevaluating, coming with a different perspective to understand it. It's one of the shifts that sometimes happens in Buddhist practice is to move from the personal story to the universal story. And so much of what we take as personal comes with being a human being. Human beings involves gain and loss, all kinds of loss. And people are born, people die, we get old, we get sick. And those are universal human experiences. They're part of the universal story of people. It's like this template. Human beings will experience loss and death. And that's just kind of universal. And then we take it so personal. Oh, it's just me. You know, it's all about yourself, me, myself, and mine. And to shift from from personal to universal helps to some of the loosening of identification. Any other ideas? So, the investigation of emotions is very important. So recognizing an emotion is paramount. Without recognizing the presence of an emotion, then you're caught by it. There's no freedom there. So we have to learn to recognize emotion. After recognizing it, it helps if we accept it. And acceptance in Buddhist language doesn't mean condoning it, or it doesn't mean kind of being a pushover for things. It means that the heart of the mind, it's the heart and mind doesn't contract or hold on to or push away what the experience is. What your wise common sense will say but what to do about the situation will vary, but there's no reason for your mind to, or your heart to contract or to resist or to push away, hold on. So acceptance means what you do with awareness. We accept it into the field of awareness fully and completely. So there's recognition, there's acceptance. Then there's the investigation, which is very important. And one of the reasons why we try to learn to recognize and accept the presence there, learn how to be present for it, is so we can investigate more precisely what's going on here. What are the different elements of the emotion we're having? If we simply give expression to emotion or just simply take it for the surface of what it is, we miss some of the roots of it. And what we want to try to do is get down to the deeper roots of that are stimulating, that are seeds, or the, maybe it's the wrong mixing of similes, but that's a source for what's on the surface. So, for example, if you feel, it's very classic, that often anger is more like surface emotion. And often what's underneath anger might be hurt, it might be fear. And if a person can drop, kind of be present for the anger, accept it, not push it away, just really feel it and see it, allow it to be there, then it might be possible to see in the cracks of the anger that actually is being fueled by fear or by hurt. And I find in my personal life that I found that it's not very useful to have conversations with people when I'm angry with them. What I try to do, I don't try to ignore the conflict, but I try to wait until I'm no longer angry. And in exploration of my anger, I also try to understand what else is going on. And if I can find that there's fear or hurt that's underlying it, then I'll talk from the place of fear or hurt. See, I feel afraid. Or I feel, when you said that, I felt really hurt. And then I found that the conversation works a lot better, because the person's not much less likely to get defensive. And it's not about them, you're attacking them. So it's to come back to the subjective. What's going on here? And one of the keys to this exploration around emotions is to notice whether the emotion or the story around the emotion is pointed outwards to someone else. If there's an object to the emotion, are you angry with that person? Are you desirous of that person? Is it something to do with the other person? Then there's a very good chance that you're missing what's really at the source, at the root in yourself. If you're always focusing outside to the person, that person is to blame, that person is the source of my joy or my happiness. You know, I only have love in my life if that person gives it to me. And that's not really, that's kind of surface, and it's a very important part of our lives to, in its own way. But what we try to do in mindfulness is turn away from, in mindfulness practice, in common sense situations, you might not want to do this, but in mindfulness practice, you want to turn away from the object of your emotion and turn the attention around to be with the subjective experience of the emotion. And then it might break up and open up to be something else. If you're really hanging on to the person you're angry with or the person that you love or whatever, and it's all about that object out there, the object of your desire, it's actually in some ways blinding. And if you're holding on to it, clinging to it, you can't really see what's going on with yourself. So there has to be a turning away, a turning around of the attention to be with the subjective state so we can really see what's going on here. If a person's filled with fear and it's uncertain what they're afraid of, but they're always directing their attention external to themselves as a way to somehow find safety or security or protect themselves or something, it might be useful to do that in certain circumstances, but again, it's always turned away. You want to turn around and feel the subjective state of fear. If you have delight, when I was in the monastery in Tassajara, I saw myself and a lot of people, the monastic life lends itself to becoming very open-hearted and lots of feeling of love and being open-hearted. And one of the consequences of that is it's really easy to fall in love. And people are falling in love with Tassajara all the time. And you can fall in love inappropriately because you're so ready, you know, like, wow. And what I found is that if I turned away from the object of my desire and focused again on the subjective, it was actually much more sublime and much more profound. The open-heartedness, the depth of what's possible there, the doorway into deeper access to delight and love. But if I took a detour and got focused on the person, And that something outside of me became the object of the love or the desire, it tended to, again, blind me or put blinders on me from what was possible deep inside. So part of the training of mindfulness is a training to learn how to turn around to what's happening subjectively. You stop blaming someone or wanting someone, and what's happening here inside. And then it can sometimes start breaking up into not just being this kind of solid thing, but into all the different elements that make up that experience. All the different emotions that make it up, all the different aspects of it, the stories, the beliefs, the sensations, the different emotions that make it up. At the root of a lot of things are fear, our desire, our hate or ill will or aversion, is delusion. And those are considered in Buddhist tradition to be very primary, not in the way I talked about earlier, but very root. It's called the roots to the whole big edifice of our emotional life. Those are called unhelpful ones, unwholesome ones. And then there's generosity, love, and wisdom, which are considered to be the wholesome roots. So our whole edifice of our emotional life can be built on this foundation of either the three unhelpful states of greed, hate, and delusion, or the wholesome states of generosity, love, and wisdom. And that requires this subjective turning in so we can get to the roots and really see what's going on here. Using the word subjective probably isn't completely adequate, but I think since so many of us are focused on objects, the object of our attention, the object of what we want, we can treat ourselves as objects, which is very painful also. We treat ourselves as an object that we, as a self-image, we hold ourselves as an image of who we are. That's treating ourselves as an object. If we have some fixed concept of who we are, that's treating ourselves as an object. they're also, you need to turn away from the idea we have of who we are and into actually what's actually subjectively going on in the moment. And that's where it begins loosening up. A lot of what Buddhist practice is aiming at is loosening up the frozen way in which we hold on to our emotional lives, we hold on to our thoughts. And the grip of the mind is quite powerful. The grip of desire, the grip of fear, the grip of aversion. The mind kind of tightens down on its ideas, on what it wants and doesn't want. And to begin loosening that grip, the grip of thoughts, the frozen feelings in the body. So they begin flowing and breaking up and dissolving. And is part of what happens as we practice. So the function of investigation is to begin seeing more what's going on, to look and discover. Do you have any questions about that? Yes. No, it's clinging. Not knowing, being confused about how things are. Being confused about who you are. Being deluded about who you are, for example. There's a lot of self-delusion going around. As soon as we've put ourselves into a category, say, this is who I am, there's delusion is operating. Any fixed category always leaves something out. So we're always more than a fixed category. So any fixed category that definitively defines this is who I am is a form of delusion. Yeah, can be. We can cling to our aversion too. Okay, let's sit again. So again, if you would like to stand and stretch and in your body, putting your body in a dignified posture. There's a wonderful relationship between our emotional life and our body that goes in both directions. And so if you take a posture that is dignified, upright, it actually helps your emotional life. It helps your inner life. Take a posture that expresses being alert, being awake. Focusing on your spine. Kind of slowly go up your spine. And be very attentive to as many of the vertebrae as you can, from the bottom going up. That your vertebrae are not just comfortable, but upright, alert. Sitting quietly, taking two or three deeper breaths. It's a way of connecting to your body. And as you breathe out a little more fully than usual, and let go. Let go of your thoughts, let go of your attention in your body. Letting your breath be normal. And very softly, but firmly, let the breathing be connected to your awareness. Let the breathing come into the field of your awareness so that each breath that you that occurs passes across the field of awareness, kind of like waves washing back and forth up and down across the beach. So the waves of the breath wash up and down across the field, the beach of your awareness. And then as you're sitting here quietly, become aware of your thinking. don't need to stop thinking. If your thinking stops, then you can go back to your breathing. And when the thinking stops, starts again, see if you can become aware of your thinking. Not what you're thinking about, but as if there's an inner voice that does the thinking. There's a speaking in there. And notice the quality of that inner voice. Does that inner voice, is it soft? Is it harsh? Is it kind? Is it aggressive? Is it hesitant? Assertive? Is it scared? Is it confident? Don't strain to notice this, but as you go proceed through the sitting and you notice your thinking, see if you can kind of listen to your way you think. See if you can notice the quality of that inner voice. Is it loud or very quiet? And then that thinking process that you can tune into, the thinking mind, is there any emotion that seems to characterize it? Is it delighted or oppressed, worried or excited or calm or agitated? Afraid? It might be very, very subtle, the emotional sense, most emotional background for that thinking mind. As if your awareness is very relaxed and broad, be aware of the emotional tone of your thinking voice. If you can't do it, just be open to the possibility you can do it. If you need to go back to the breathing at any time, you can go back and stabilize yourself with the breath. Be with the breath for a while. Enjoy the breath. Let yourself be at ease. At ease with whatever's going on, and mindful, awake to the particulars of your experience, the breath, of thoughts, of feelings. Notice the emotion that may be very subtle, but those that are connected to your thinking mind. And then coming to the last minute of this sitting, spend a minute reviewing the sitting. What happened? How were you? How were you engaged? What did you discover? Without judging the sitting or yourself, are there simple ways in which you might have been more engaged or more present? One of the advantages of having this mic right in front of me is that when I started drifting or a little bit falling asleep, I knew right away. Were you, any of you able to track that your thoughts a little bit and the voice that does the thinking and the emotion? The subtle emotions of the thinking mind. What did you discover there? The only small thing I wanted to say, kind of as a little footnote to what you said, was in being raped, there's a kind of loss of self, I suppose, fear of losing self. And Buddhist tradition puts a lot of emphasis on in a certain way of losing self. And there's a ways in which they can be done in a healthy way and an unhealthy way, and that they too can get confused. And that can be a problem when they too get confused. I think if it involves a denial or dismissing of parts of ourselves or a disowning of parts of ourselves, you know, the thing about not taking things personally and identifying with things doesn't mean disowning them. Doesn't mean, you know, like this is not happening to me, you know, or being dismissive. So if there's a denial or dismissive of part of ourselves, like shutting down part of ourselves, then it's unhealthy. Probably not. Probably done enough of it. I mean, not all of them. I asked you at the last minute or so to review the sitting. Did you find that useful to do or interesting to do? Or what were the benefits of that for you? We're going to do it's now 4:12 on my watch here, clock. So we're going to have a last sitting. And before we do that last sitting, if you'd like to stand again and stretch and get some energy, swing your arms, whatever you can. In the Buddhist tradition, there's we don't have to only leave our emotions to chance, just whatever arises, and we're mindful of it. There's also practices to cultivate certain wholesome emotions, helpful emotions. And as I said at the beginning of the day, that the Buddhist path is an emotional one with a lot of helpful, wholesome emotions arise in the course of the path. But also they get cultivated in the course of the path. And there are particular practices for cultivating and developing that capacity to feel certain helpful emotions. And so these are helpful in and of themselves to develop these things. But also they work really well as antidotes or as healing qualities for our emotional life when we're really in a deep emotional distress or really stuck and frozen with certain emotional difficulties. It can be very helpful to bring in some of the opposite quality of what we're stuck in. And the two kind of practices that I'm thinking of that are very helpful in relationship to emotions and getting our emotions to move again so they're not so stuck. The first is forgiveness practice, and the second is loving-kindness meditation. And sometimes those two are done together. And forgiveness meditation does not entail condoning or accepting as everything's okay, some transgression or some problem that's happened. It's always recognized that a transgression and something wrong has happened. But forgiveness means even recognizing that something terrible has happened, something wrong has happened, it's been a transgression. I'm willing to open my heart to be good-willed towards this person again, to be kindly disposed to this person, not to hold my heart frozen or tight or have a barrier between me and this person or a barrier between the person and me. And it doesn't say, ignore what's happened. But it's really, forgiveness meditation is beginning to release the grip that's held in our own heart. And then loving kindness meditation is to cultivate further the goodwill we have towards ourselves and to others. And to wish ourselves happiness, to wish other people happiness, can be done with clinging. It can also be done as a natural, innate goodness of our own heart. To simply see someone who you feel nice towards and wish them further happiness or happiness is a very innate, natural thing to do. It can seem not natural to do it towards ourselves, but actually it is also. When the mind is really settled and quiet and all the superficial judgments and ideas and fears kind of settle away, it's quite innate in the goodness of our heart to wish ourselves, to want ourselves happiness, safety, health, well-being. It needs to be done without expectation or demand, but just kind of to have that natural wish. And that natural wish in and of itself can bring happiness. To know that there's that part of us that wants others to be happy, to know wants us to be happy. That there's that part of us that kind of looks out for ourselves or wants the best in ourselves. To know that that's part of who we are can be very helpful. It can help loosen up the emotional life. When there's a lot of fear, a lot of anger, it can replace that with a whole different quality. And it can be very healing for that part of us which is afraid, that part of us which feels really hurt, to find the capacity in ourselves to have kindness, to have happiness, to have loving kindness, to have tenderness. So we don't have to always look outside of ourselves for a solution, but rather we have the resources inside of ourselves. And as the practice of loving kindness becomes something stronger within us, it becomes a real sense of strength, a sense of refuge, a sense of support, so that when there's anger or fear or hurt, that we're meeting it with another capacity, another strength of character, strength of ability, so it doesn't overwhelm us. It can still be there, but we're able to meet it then or join it with feelings of goodwill and kindness. Someone makes us angry, and right there, close at hand, is our wish. It would really be nice if that person was happy. The person's a jerk, and it would be nice if the person was happy. You know, it's a kind of a natural tendency, a quick tendency. It's almost a habit. So take a comfortable posture. Gently close your eyes. And very gently, softly, take two or three, four breaths mindfully. Each time you breathe out, drop down into the area of your heart, letting yourself feel whatever might be there. In particular, see if you can notice any tenderness in that part of your body. Sweet tenderness, aching tenderness, whatever tenderness it might be. Letting your breath move in and out through that area. To tenderize the heart, to release the grip that we have on things, the grip of resentment, of anger, of fear. So to start the process of forgiveness, it's a process that could take years, but to begin feeling that this is a good direction to go and a willingness to begin the path of forgiveness. It might take years before you actually can, but the willingness to begin what it takes is a very significant moment. And it's done by repeating the following phrases silently to yourself. And each time you say the phrase, to see if the intention of the phrase can kind of sink into your heart. See if you can stand behind the phrase and see in what ways it can be meaningful for you. So the phrases are this. For whatever hurt others have caused me, intentionally or unintentionally, may I forgive them. For whatever hurt others have caused me, intentionally or unintentionally, may I forgive them. For whatever hurt others have caused me, may I forgive them. And then the other is, for whatever hurt I have caused others, intentionally or unintentionally, may they forgive me. whatever hurt I have caused others, may they forgive me. And then finally, for whatever hurt I have caused myself, intentionally or unintentionally, may I forgive myself. For whatever ways I have caused harm to myself, may I forgive myself. And then, if it's available, staying with a sense of tenderness towards yourself, within yourself. Begin by having some thoughts of goodwill towards yourself. Just think. Reflect, think. Any thoughts you'd like that express goodwill toward yourself. How it'd be nice if you could be happy. And then you can repeat the following phrases silently to yourself, sinking into the meaning or the intention of the words. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at ease. Feeling your physical body, your emotional body. Feeling yourself from the inside out. Perhaps trying to be a little bit at home with yourself. Accepting of yourself. Friendly with yourself. Repeat the words again. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at ease. And then bring to mind a benefactor, someone who has cared about you, someone who has extended themselves to help you or care for you in some way. Maybe think of this person when this person is happy, when there's a smile on the person's face or a glitter in their eyes. Imagine, you know, look, imagine the person with their full capacity for happiness. And wouldn't it be nice if this benefactor was happy? Repeat the words. May you be happy. May you be safe. Shanti. May you be at ease. And then bring to mind some person, friend or colleague or relative or someone that you might be seeing this weekend or next few days. Bring them to mind. Maybe visualize them or reflect on their that they have a capacity to be happy. They have the capacity to be at ease. And wish this person the best. Best. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at ease. And then relaxing and extending yourself out to the people in this room. People you've been sitting with during the day, some of them you've heard, and some you haven't spoken. But everyone here. And see if in your own way, whatever way your is, way is your own, extend your goodwill to the people here in this room, including yourself. May all of us be happy. May all of us be safe. May all of us be healthy. May all of us be at ease. And then beyond this room, out into Redwood City and the rest of the peninsula, all the many beings and people that we'll encounter. Wouldn't it be great if there was happiness and safety and joy for everyone? Of course, you can't expect it to be thorough, but it's such a wonderful thing to wish it, to have the intention that this be the case. To have your open-heartedness spill out so that the cynic, the skeptic in you, the fearful one in you, the aversive one in you, it doesn't limit, doesn't put a hold in your capacity to really wish the best for everyone throughout this wider community. May all beings be happy. May all beings live in safety. May all beings be healthy. May all beings everywhere be at ease. May all beings be happy. And may whatever benefits that have come from this day of practicing together, may we share it with all beings everywhere so they may be happy and safe. As we leave here, driving our cars or walking and encountering other people on the streets, imagine, visualize yourself giving away whatever benefits you've gotten from the day. your calm, your concentration, your self-awareness. Give it all away so all beings may be happy.